You are listening to the News Project podcast for the week of May 18th, 2020, brought to you by GNAT TV. This podcast brings you these stories. Retail begins to open back up. BRSU has concerns over the emergency ESSER fund. Broadband takes a step closer, and handing out food draws a sizable crowd.
On Monday, May 18th, non-essential retail shops were given the green light to reopen their doors for in-store customers after more than 2 months of being forced to close because of the COVID-19 virus emergency. Stores can reopen with some restrictions still in place, the 6 feet of social distance separation, and employees are required to wear face masks. It's likely their customers will be asked to wear face masks as well, but so far, Governor Phil Scott has stopped short of requiring that, as other states have done. And stores will have to limit the number of customers so that they never exceed the 25% of capacity threshold. Across Manchester, though, not all shops chose to reopen just yet. Most, though not all, of the retail outlet shops remain closed, as each brand-name business made their individual decisions about when to reopen. Several locally owned businesses also decided to stick with the curbside pickup or online sales they've employed over the past 2 months of the pandemic and wait a little longer before resuming regular in-store sales. Two shops in Manchester that did opt to reopen for in-store traffic were the Mountain Goat, a hiking and outdoor adventure gear shop, and the Northshire Bookstore. We spoke with Aaron Krinsky, the manager of the Mountain Goat.
We're excited. We're just going to wait to see what happens. We're not really sure what to expect, so we're going to just handle it as it comes. But we're definitely happy to be back. We've needed something to do. Yep, we've been doing a lot of phone orders, curbside delivery. We set up some online shopping with a locally website. Just doing everything we could to maintain some sort of traffic. But curbside has definitely been our strongest asset. Yep, so we're trying to adhere to the state guidelines. We're requiring masks. We're asking all customers to wear a mask. We're maintaining that 6 foot distance. We're wiping down all surfaces as best we can, and we're really minimizing any of that contact. Certain things like footwear, where it's a really hands-on thing, we're taking a step back, so we're doing what we can given the circumstances, yeah.
Then it was across the street to the Northshire Bookstore, where we caught up with Chris Morrow, the store's owner.
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of curbside and tremendous amount of online sales with a skeleton crew. So the folks that have been here have been doing a fantastic job, just working like crazy. And really, a lot of people are doing different jobs than they were 2 months ago. You know, we had one person working part-time on internet fulfillment, and now we have about four. Well, Vermont seems like it's ready to open. The number of cases is relatively low, and we're confident that our customers will be respectful of the staff and each other. Frankly, we need to get rolling as quickly as we can. You know, business is tenuous, and we need to get back at it.
But not all independently owned businesses saw Monday as the best time to reopen after 2 months of adjustment. One of them was Vermont Kitchen Supply, where the owner, Carrie Camolo McKinnon, described her thinking on that.
Just pushing it back to June 1st, and we're doing it for a few different reasons. It's just right now, I still have new merchandise coming in, so I don't have a way to keep the store sanitized and safe and have people in it at the same time. So we're continuing the curbside and credit card business that we've been doing. I mean, it's not exactly what I would want to do. It's not financially sustainable, and it's a little draining. But I just think that, like here you see, this is one delivery. We're gonna have probably three more today. I'm here by myself unloading boxes. I just don't have enough people. So just want to be safe, and I'm gonna continue to err on the side of safety. And that's all I don't know what else to do, you know, and I appreciate that people are opening today, and God bless them, but we just have so much merchandise coming in, I just feel like it would be unsafe right now, so.
If COVID-19 infection rates continue to stay low, outdoor dining, close contact businesses like hair salons, and other indoor businesses could open by June 1st. The state's limit on gatherings, now set at 10, would be expanded to 25 people. Effective May 22nd, lodging businesses will be able to accept overnight reservations from people who have met 14-day quarantine requirements. Vermont residents and those who have been quarantined will have to fill out a questionnaire affirming that they've met the quarantine requirements. And lodging operations, with some exceptions, will have to stay at 25% of capacity as well, like the retail shops. As the governor likes to put it, one quarter turn of the spigot at a time. That's becoming possible because Vermont is one of the lowest, if not the lowest, virus infection rates in the country. For the JNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeown.
And another issue I should just bring to your attention, but it's concerning, is that there are also ESSER funds and those emergency secondary relief. I may have the acronym incorrect, but Sue and I have been involved in a conversation around that with Vermont Superintendents Association. And it's quite interesting how those funds, the plan for those funds being given out. So to try not to get too much into the weeds here, the funds would be allocated to us based on our Title I allocation. So every year we get a certain amount of funds based on Title I, meaning the poverty levels within our supervisory union. So funds would be allocated based on our poverty levels, but the guidance from DeVos says that we have to disperse those funds in a Title IIA fashion, meaning that we would have to distribute those funds to any student based on enrollment within our supervisory union, and that includes the independent schools. So there could be an application to have some of those monies from our independent schools, and that does not have to be based on need. But the funds are given to us based on need.
Wow.
So that's about, it's a potential for maybe 60% of those funds that would come to us to support students in need could be allocated to independent schools. It's a very different set of rules. So none of us understand that. It just does not make any sense. So that, and it's enrollment of the school. So if there are 200 kids at an independent school, it does not matter where they live or where they come from. They could be overseas students. The fact that they attend that school, they count, and we have to distribute funds to them.
And is this
that shows you a political agenda. So I'm just going to put myself out there, but it is a political agenda.
And the state in this case is on the hook to follow the agenda coming down from the federal education.
That's correct.
Okay.
Do you mean they're distributed surely by numbers then?
Not based on need.
But for any, there's no other.
Except they come to us based on need.
Right, but do they have to justify it for any particular reason? No, okay.
But there are restrictions on it. It's not like we just hand them a bunch of money. It doesn't work that way. But
we have to do everything.
But it comes up.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound all that dissimilar from the issue of the PPP funds, where you had companies, lofts claiming millions of dollars where other smaller businesses couldn't get access to any of that money. It had it has a similar kind of non-specified principle. So you could go in as the Sugar Shack or the Shake Shack or whatever it is and get a $10 million loan, whereas the pizza parlor down the street is all the way out in the cold. And maybe they're not analogous, but there's something.
Yeah. It just doesn't feel right. So we'll see how that all shakes out. But I've reviewed the guidance. It's and the onus is really all on us to do. It's the LEA has to pretty much oversee everything. It's a huge job. It's not to say that the independent schools don't have to, provide us with information, but it's really, it's very one-sided for sure. So, and it's one of the downsides of a supervisor union that has so much choice. It's going to impact us in a negative way.
Broadband service has been in the news a lot in recent weeks and months as the COVID-19 pandemic has forced schools, businesses, hospitals, and ordinary people online for information and delivering services of one kind or another. Whether it's a Zoom meeting, remote learning, remote working, or telemedicine, modern broadband access and bandwidth speeds have emerged as indispensable tools to cope with the dislocation caused by the pandemic. Two routes to supplying better broadband to underserved areas are developing. One is the Communication Union Districts that received state legislative support last year through Act 79, which set aside about $700,000 in state funds for feasibility studies for locally proposed districts. If successful, those districts could receive up to $60,000 for each district to develop a business plan to see if upgrading the local broadband infrastructure made sense financially. One of these grants was won recently by the newly formed Southern Vermont Communications Union District, centered on Bennington County. Another route that is under discussion is the Emergency Broadband Action Plan, a response by the state's Department of Public Service to the pandemic and the disruption it has caused. The plan seeks to ensure that all Vermonters have access to the Internet at home when a public emergency requires sheltering in place. According to the department, about 23% of the state, nearly 70,000 businesses and residences, currently don't have access to modern levels of broadband, defined as 25 megabits per second of download speed and 3 megabits per second of upload speed. With no real certainty about how long the coronavirus pandemic will continue to affect homes, businesses, schools, and other institutions, the urgency of upgrading the state's broadband capacity has risen. The Emergency Broadband Action Plan does call for direct financial support to Communication Union Districts, or CUDs, through the state's Broadband Innovation Grant Program. To get a handle on where all this is going, we got together, online of course, with three people who've been closely involved in these efforts. Tim Scoggins, the chairman of the Southern Vermont Communications Union District, who also serves as the chairman of the Shaftesbury Select Board, Jonathan Cooper of the Bennington County Regional Commission, and Representative Laura Sibilia, a state representative from Dover, who was one of the driving forces behind Act 79. We began by asking Tim Scoggins what were the next steps now that the Southern Vermont Communications Union District was formed.
What happens next? What's that feasibility grant going to be used for, and what will be sort of the next steps that we're going to be seeing?
Well, the point of the feasibility grant is to help get the CUDs off the ground. So they will be doing a two-part study, a feasibility study that will evaluate whether or not our group has a likelihood of making the whole thing work, getting a broadband network built in terms of just the large, I guess you might call it, 30,000 foot view of feasibility. You know, is there a hope for it to work? If that is deemed to be the case, there's a second part that would go forward after approval by the state that would allow us and our consultants to develop an actual business plan, a three-year business plan that would give more details and more specific financial information on how we get to a building of a network that is cash flow positive in 3 years. That's the requirement of the.
And Jonathan, what's going to be the BCRC's role in all of this? So you guys play a big role in getting that grant approved. What will that still be something you'll be working on as well going forward?
So BCRC has a more administrative role with respect to the Broadband Innovation Grant in terms of being able to sort of receive the funds from the states. One of the values of working with the regional planning commissions for a lot of the CUDs was, as those CUDs were getting the pieces put in place for organizational structure, there were some requirements for funding that the BCRC could meet in terms of having a a DUNS number, having a, or so being registered with Dun & Bradstreet, having its insurance, being able to provide, you know, proof of insurance, et cetera, that are just sort of more boilerplate requirements or housekeeping requirements for the state to grant, make grants to any sort of, to any entity. In terms of activity on the Broadband Innovation Grant itself, the application really spelled out who would be doing what, and it's largely in the hands of the sort of consultants that will be undertaking a lot of the work. BCRC sort of continues to provide a little bit of outside guidance or doing a little bit of research about other options and opportunities to try to continue providing support to the CUD on an as-needed basis.
So how does this interface with the state plan? We've been hearing a little bit about, the Department of Public Service came out with, I think it was called an emergency broadband plan, and kind of in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, that potentially might be able to tap into some of the federal CARES money. And would that it sounded like what they were trying to do is something very similar to what we're trying to get done here in Bennington County, get broadband access to folks that don't have it. Is there a tie-in between the two, or is that separate tracks?
No, there's certainly a tie-in, and there's certainly a lot of communication going on right now. And exactly the nature of that tie-in is a matter of large debate from the CUDs up through the Department of Public Service onto the legislature. As in, to what extent do we, the state, the CUDs, shift gears to take advantage of COVID relief money and to get some sort of internet to people who desperately need it right now? Or do we stay on track with our plan and the state mandate for real good future-proof symmetrical internet service, which probably means fiber? So that's something that we're struggling with. The plan that has been put forward, the Emergency Broadband Action Plan, I think is a good one, because it mostly talks about staying on track with our 2024 plan, the state's 2024 plan of getting broadband to everyone. But it does acknowledge that there is real need for a lot of people right now, given the lockdown and concerns that come the fall, are we going to be able to start school again? Or are we still going to be trying to do distance learning? And if that's the case, we have to recognize that we still have got 20-25% of the homes in the state don't have internet access that would allow students to do distance learning. So that's something that has to be considered. But exactly how those two interact, as I say, is a matter of much ongoing debate right now.
In a separate Zoom conversation, we asked Representative Sebelia about her take on boosting broadband capacity in Vermont.
What is your sense of the possibility that some of the federal CARES money that's coming to Vermont might be deployed towards boosting broadband service across the state?
So I think there's a tremendous amount of interest in that. The funds, we understand the funds need to be spent by December 31st. Act 79, what we put in place last year, basically said to our communities, well, we don't have the funds to connect you. The providers that are operating in a competitive for-profit market are not going to connect you. That's why you're not connected. And so you're going to have to do it yourself. And here are some tools. The formation of the Communications Union District. And we've seen a number of those already form and more trying to form throughout the state. And how can we help you people on the ground, volunteers on the ground, how can we help you get it done? So thinking about the CARES Act, for me personally, it's important to me that we not undermine the very volunteers that we asked to stand up and take on this monumental task who have responded and said, yes, we will. And yet as they're forming, they're babies and they're volunteers, right? In many cases. And so, you know, how can we get the supports and develop enough planning and even just the construction infrastructure to spend those funds by December 31st? That's a very, that's an open question that is being wrestled with every day by legislators like myself, my chair, Ledge Council, the Department of Public Service, our number of our counterparts in the Senate. And I think there's a desire to absolutely utilize to the greatest extent that we can as responsibly as possible care funds, but there's no guarantee. My bias is definitely towards fiber with some wireless problem solving interspersed where absolutely necessary and where we're able to monitor it. And I would also say my bias is toward, I really see the CUDs as the democratization of the telecommunications network in Vermont. It's really largely been a for-profit product. Seen that way, it's been regulated by the market, in the internet, and you know, as we talked about, there's so much to modern life that's it's critical infrastructure, education, healthcare, working, access to government. It is like electricity. There's no question. It is like electricity. And so we need that to be brought much more into the public realm and have the public be able to ensure that all Vermonters have it. And you know, the CUDs, I think, are our foray into ensuring that.
The House Energy and Technology Committee is studying the emergency broadband proposal advanced by the Department of Public Service. Stay tuned. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. On Tuesday, May 19th, the Vermont National Guard, the Vermont Food Bank, and the Abbey Group, a food service management company specializing in handcrafted foods that use local ingredients, teamed up to distribute cartons of food to area families. The distribution event, held at the Bromley Mountain parking lot off of Route 11 in Peru, drew a sizable crowd by the time the food packages began to be handed out at 10 o'clock, with a long line of cars steadily streaming into the parking area, familiar to generations of skiers and summer visitors. It was only one of several such events being held around the state as the COVID-19 emergency has forced businesses to close or curtail their operations, throwing thousands of Vermonters out of work and now struggling to make ends meet and put food on the family table. Adam King was one of the National Guard members and told us what was going on.
Right. We have fresh food, so we have three tractor trailer loads of fresh food, which is what I'm told is about enough for 1,000 families. And then in addition to that, we have MREs if we need to. And we also have box meals that are shelf-stable meals that we're prepared to hand out here as well today.
The morning was a blur of food being unloaded from the delivery trucks and being put into position for the distribution. Chris Thayer of the Vermont Food Bank and Nina Hansen of the Abbey Group described their parts in the event.
Actually, today we're receiving the product that comes off the trucks. And I actually spoke to the guard, and we're gonna actually help hand food out to the cars and stuff. They're a little short on help today, and we're willing to do whatever, so, yeah.
We're actually an intermediary. The state of Vermont reached out to us to bid on a USDA program called Farmers to Families Food Boxes. And the idea being that we would purchase as much as we could from our Vermont farmers and also some additional products from outside the state and be reimbursed for that, but donate it to the food bank, and then it would be distributed to families with the through the National Guard. So it's 2 gallons of milk, 2 cases of chicken, which is 20 pounds, a 25-pound box of fresh produce, and a 7.5-pound box of mixed cheese and butter.
The food distribution was scheduled to continue until 2 p.m., or until the supplies ran out. More such distribution events are in the works.
Then we're in Middlebury tomorrow, and then Thetford the day after that. The whole schedule is up on the Vermont Food Bank website. If anybody wants to check it out, they can go there and see where we're going to be each day the next 2 weeks.
For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.